Thank you very much, Steve. I've noticed how many discarded notes you have.
Yes, I took a few out, yes.
When I pop off, if you want to talk about my life, you won't have so many. Well, let's have a little pause before you fire all your questions. I know you're bursting with them. I can see from your eager faces. So I just sit down for a moment and I'll wait the first contribution. And I'm looking for it. Yes.
You start off this thing by saying English nationalists have hijacked this poem, Jerusalem. I mean, I didn't know much about Blake, but I know it. Jerusalem shouldn't be signed at a Tory party in conference. I mean, it's incomprehensible that people knew what it was intended to mean. You didn't analyze the poem, Jerusalem.
No, I didn't. We'll take a few questions and I'll
come back. You want to take a few and come back all at once, all right? Any others? While they're waiting, I've just made a couple of little notes on something you said. You talked about Blake and his description petrifying the human imagination. And I sometimes wonder, when all the time, as a pacifist, of course, all the time people talk about the innate aggression in human beings, I've always wondered whether that innate aggression was probably the repression of something far deeper in us, which is our desire for culture and art and the fulfilling of that imagination and nothing more, and it's not innate at all. And the other thing I wanted to say too was that Sophocles made a bit of mistake when he said that all these bad things were a result of wisdom. They weren't. They were a result of knowledge, which was not applied with wisdom, which is rather different. And it's a common mistake that people make to equate the acquisition of knowledge with the application of wisdom. And it's a serious mistake that holds us back as human species. The last thing, I'd just like to make a comment aside about James Lovelock, because I was deeply disappointed to find James Lovelock justifying the existence of nuclear power and all of that stuff, which rather gelled with his view of the Gaia.
Yeah.
And many of my friends wouldn't believe it when I pointed that out to him, but he was actually supporting the nuclear waste stations and saying untruthfully how little came out of them. And how little it was and how easy it was to store and all that, which is complete rubbish, of course. So there's those three things from me while we're still waiting.
Perhaps if we hear the speaker's comments on those questions, that may feed into further comments.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean the poem Jerusalem, and did those feet in ancient time walk on England, green and pleasant land. It's actually about whether Jesus had actually ever visited England. That's what it's about, originally. And, it's popular because of the Dark Satanic Mills quote. But it's adjected by a lot of like rugby union matches where they used to sing sort of like Jerusalem and Blake poems. But, I just think it's actually a religious poem. It's been hijacked by everybody wants it, you know. They love it. And it's been set to music by some guy called Hubert Parry. The Tories, haven't they, at their conference, the Women's Institute also use it as well. So everybody wants a slice of William Blake, you see. Yes, what Richard's saying about, like, you know, the aggression is innate in humanity, you know, and relating it to the petrifying of the human imagination and linking it to desire. Yeah, I think Blake was like that. I don't think Blake believed in... He didn't believe in... He actually believed in some sort of innate goodness in humanity. And I think what you're saying is like this sort of like not being able to create can lead to aggression. Yeah, I think William Blake would actually go along with that. Yeah, the Sophocles thing... knowledge and wisdom. Yes, I mean, Oedipus is obviously, he has knowledge of what he has done and it brings him no good fortune and wisdom obviously is a different thing. But he does, yeah, he does write. I mean, I've quoted Sophocles correctly, but
used wisdom.
But he does use the word wisdom in the translation that I came across. But I mean, knowledge of nuclear fission is ultimately a bad thing for humanity. The James Lovelock, the Gaia thing, I mean, it is an hypothesis. I've actually spoken about Gaia before, and I got picked up on the fact that it is an hypothesis, and it's not a theory. The nuclear power, yes, I mean, I'm quite shocked, actually. I didn't realise he actually supported that. But, yeah, I don't know if that's going to lead anybody to ask any further questions, but, yeah.
Yes, I
had a question, but it's in defense of Lovelock. Hmm. His argument is that this is burning the fossil fuels that's causing global warming, as has been shown. The only alternative to it that's practical is nuclear power. And I don't think that's necessarily a hypothesis or a view that should be dismissed.
You missed the point.
We may need, when we have socialism, to use nuclear power instead of burning fossil fuels.
Wasn't the point of what I was saying? If that was the argument he was making, come out and say it honestly. Why tell lies about the non-danger of storing nuclear waste? That was the point I was making. He's doing the same as politicians. Instead of making that argument, he's justifying it by telling lies. And that's what's unforgivable from Lovelock.
Derail the discussion onto the Lovelock.
Yeah. No. Yeah. But
yeah. But the Gaia idea is only an hypothesis anyway, because it's not scientifically proven, so it's not a theory.
Yes?
Right, you missed out a bit on women's liberation, freedom of the family, and I thought that might have been really interesting.
Yeah, well, I was conscious of the time, and
we've got time now, because
yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
we
can carry on the talk now. Yeah, I mean, Blake was a friend of Mary Wollstonecraft, you know, who was the partner of William Godwin. I mean, she married William Godwin in 1797. I mean, their daughter Mary would marry Shelley. I mean, Wollstonecraft in her book talked about, I mean, she was a friend of Blake's and obviously a friend as well. And she wrote about women were enslaved in the institution of marriage, and she saw loveless marriage as no different to prostitution. I mean, in one of her novels, she wrote, "The heroine longs to enter that world where there is neither marrying nor giving in marriage." I mean, Blake echoed this in Jerusalem, not to the short poem that Adam was referring to, but an epic poem that he wrote called Jerusalem. And Blake wrote, "In eternity, they neither marry nor are given in marriage." So he explicitly compared the sexual oppression of marriage to slavery, and was critical of the marriage laws of his day. And then, like I say, Mary Wollstonecraft again believed in free love and not being tied down to one partner, and gave birth outside of the marriage state. I did mention it in my sort of in that synopsis I've provided. He did write a poem called The Visions of the Daughters of Albion, but it was too long to print out several hundred lines. But in that poem, he talks about free love. The argument by Blake is outlined by the editor of this book here, The Complete Poems of William Blake. And she writes, this is what Blake is arguing in the poem, "The God of reason is wrong, for all individuals are unique and have their own forms, visions and joys. The false holiness of church and state wastes and exploits human energy. It also enforces loveless marriages, which in turn produce monstrous children. Childhood should begin in erotic, pleasure-loving infancy, and move freely towards a mature sexuality, which will bring vigour and bliss. The teachings of modesty distort this process and produce hypocrisy, self-righteousness, and shame. Conventional virginity, however, is only repressed desire, which must lead to autoeroticism, a fruitless perversion. True love is free. Possessiveness is not love." I mean, I think, Carla, that William Blake, he anticipates ideas of Wilhelm Reich in the 20th century, again saying how much out of time William Blake was and how much he still is out of time.
Was he married?
Yes. No children, which is interesting because obviously,
And Mary Wollstonecraft was ostracised once she had a child.
Yeah, and then she came with a guy called Gilbert Imlay, she had the child with, and eventually she got together with William Godwin, but she died in childbirth, I believe, didn't she? Yeah. Yes, so he didn't like the whole idea of the family structure. This is from Socialist Standard in 1913. We wrote, "Sex nature in women has been reduced by capitalism to the level of a commodity. The degradation of women as a sex is but a special aspect of the general degradation of humanity." And we wrote in the Socialist Standard, in the same article, "In socialism, modern marriage and the present so-called family life, like other legal institutions with their sordid monetary and proprietary bases, will be relegated to the limbo of the forgotten past." So I think we're on with Blake there, aren't we? I mean, Blake, sorry.
Yeah. What did his wife do?
But basically, he'd sort of trained her in all the printing and the engraving. So she worked with him. His job was as an engraver. He was a poet and an artist. He didn't make a lot of money from that. He was an engraver. And so she worked with him doing the actual engraving. And I think she was illiterate when he married her. And obviously he would have taught her to read. And they used to read together. I did want to say something, yes. I don't want to paint this picture that William Blake is some sort of feminist. Because Peter Ackroyd, in his book here, said at the end of his life, Blake declared that wives ought to be shared in common. Now, this is open to interpretation. I mean, is he a patriarchal sort of a sexual communist, or is he a real sexual communist? And, like, men should be also shared in common. I mean, the Marquis de Sade, he was a sort of sexual communist, and he was a bit of a patriarch as well. But to be fair to the Marquis de Sade, one of his novels, Juliet, which was subtitled The Prosperities of Vice, is actually a hymn to liberated, unbridled female sexuality. So I don't know about Blake. I mean, he probably would have had some patriarchal attitudes because he couldn't fail not to have such attitudes in the early 19th century. But Peter Ackroyd, like, points out that he said that near the end of his life. But like I said, I don't know what that really means. I mean, wives ought to be shared in common. Does it mean men share wives in common, or men and women are sharing each other in common?
H.R. Mencken put it in a modern way.
Yeah.
He said adultery was a democracy applied to marriage.
Yes. <Good one. laughs> Yeah. Yes, I put a lot into the talk, and obviously I was conscious of the time, and that's why I took out a few things. I hope I've answered a few questions for you, Carla.
Yes. I think Blake, in approaching a political philosophy or a political program, did he subscribe to political action in any way?
No, I mean, Blake was friendly and would have attended a lot of those meetings in early 1790s London, you know, which were, you know, groups set up in the artisan class to propagate ideas of freedom and following on from the French Revolution. No, Blake was not political by any means, really. What I've drawn out from his poetry is religious mythology, is ideas of the state and law. But he subscribed to no political programme. I mean, he was a supporter of the French Revolution, but obviously was dismayed when it degenerated into sort of revolutionary terror and violence. But as pointed out, the French Revolution, and a lot of people like praise the French Revolution, but the French Revolution is the bourgeois liberal revolution, isn't it? I mean, it was a necessary stage in history, you know, the transformation from feudalism to capitalism. So like I say, he was involved with these sort of groups and like friendly with Godwin, Compayne. Like I said, shared a few of Compayne's views on the state, but like I said, I mean, Compayne believed in commerce. I mean, Blake, the idea of commerce is the petrifying of the human imagination. Capitalism, commerce.
I think that's true, isn't it? I mean, I must say, in my own life, some of the most changing political thoughts I've had have come through poetry, not through political writers. Mm. And in the words of a poet, often what they don't express through revolutionary activity, they find expression to there.
Yeah. Yeah, well.
Which is their medium, if you like.
Well, I mean, I came across William Blake when I was 17, and I was A-level English literature, and we studied Songs of Innocence and Experience. And at that time, I was interested in politics and current affairs. But he actually pushed me towards the left. He pushed me towards being a socialist in 1983, and then obviously the miners' strike was the following year and confirmed my belief in socialism. But yeah, William Blake is even though he's not a socialist as such, because the word socialist doesn't exist then, but he's like a good stimulus.
So many other poets, Tessimond, and many others who are not have something to say to us,
absolutely,
and to others.
Yeah.
Maybe others we can't always reach.
Indeed.
Yes.
So just you mentioned the renters.
Yes.
And I just thought that was really interesting. Is that where we get the word rent, a rent from?
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, I think these guys in the English Revolution were going around ranting, you know, taking off all their clothes and ranting, blasphemies and attacking Puritanism and things. But
Quakers were.
They were just one of these extreme sects, of the period of time. But I mean, I think E.B. Thompson, he identifies a lot of different groups of the English Revolution as being influential on Blake. But I mean, as Richard pointed out, Swedenborg was actually a very big influence on William Blake. Although he eventually rejected Swedenborg.
He did.
Eventually,
yes.
I didn't want to talk about
religion. Were Swedenborgians did.
I don't know if you want to enlighten the audience about exactly what Swedenborg believed in. And,
well, it was a bit. It was a bit of sort of. It was a basic Christian concept with a bit of visionary.
Yeah.
Mysticism mixed in.
Yeah,
he had a theory.
Yeah,
I don't really want to go into
that. Right, no problem. I try to steer clear of religion because Blake is a religious writer in some respects. But
if anyone wants to know about it, of course, Swedenborg House is still down in Holborn.
Yes,
you can pop in and they'll welcome you with open arms and give you leaflets.
I know you don't want to speak about religion, but you quote Blake's criticism of Newton.
Mm.
I mean, did Blake know that Newton was religious in that case and spent just as much time trying to interpret the revelations as he did working on apples falling off trees and things? I mean, or did anybody know at the time that Newton was in that case?
No, well, I didn't know that.
Didn't you?
No, I didn't know. I mean, but most people, even the rationalist philosophers, were all believed in God. But
he really believed his calculation. He was trying to calculate when the end of the world would come, based on what was written in the Book of Revelation.
You seem to be the sole purveyor of this information.
Yes.
Is it his statue outside the British Library?
Newton.
Isaac Newton.
Probably.
Well, I'm surprised
at what
I've just heard there.
Yeah, but that's Blake's criticism of Isaac Newton. Isaac Newton is held up as a great man.
Exactly.
You know, he's been on our pound notes, wasn't he, a few years ago?
What about, I take it it was John Wilkes you
were
talking about?
I mentioned John Wilkes briefly.
Well, you said Wilkes, so I imagine it's John Wilkes, who turned, he went after his kind of like radicalism, then went to the Obi.
Edmund Burke was a supporter of the American Revolution, the American War of Independence. And then later,
I'm talking about John Wilkes.
I never mentioned him. I mentioned him once, just by name, but I didn't really quite talk about him.
Nothing to say about him. No,
he's 1760s. He's a bit before Blake's time. Blake's time is really 1790s, and that's the time of Mary Wollstonecraft, William Godwin, Tom Paine, Edmund Burke. Although, you know, Edmund Burke was a conservative, but...
Yes?
I wonder if Blake influenced
19th
century thought in a way perhaps that Shelley did.
Chartists
were aware of Shelley's...
No, I'm not aware of that. I mean, like Shelley, his major poem was The Mask of Anarchy, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That was quite popular amongst the artisan class and working class in the 19th century. And I think Blake's major influence has been on artistic creators, hasn't he? You know, music, musicians, and other writers. And I don't know about the Chartists in any connections with Blake. Like I say, the question about Blake and his political program. He didn't have a political program, and I would have thought for a lot of time in the 19th century, I think Blake would have been his ideas about free love and such like and family would have been. Viewed with abhorrence by the Victorians, I would have thought.
They would have been.
Yeah.
John Wilkes was a man of great wit.
He was, I can tell you that.
And I remember once when a rather dubious politician assailed him in the Strand and said, "I declare Wilkes you'll die by the rope or the pox." To which Wilkes replied, "That depends, sir, on whether I embrace your principles or your mistress."
Yeah, good one.
He was very quick, very quick man, John Wilkes. Any other?
He did join the Whigs, didn't he?
Yes. But I think with all of these things, I mean, Blake, of course, had such a multifaceted life. I mean, the people I mentioned at the beginning weren't radicals. And Samuel Palmer made lovely, glowing pictures. Yeah. Burne Jones was very religious.
But
they were all connected. Palmer was his friend. Burne Jones was Palmer's friend. And there was that whole sort of movement of the which linked the ancients, as Blake called his little group, with the romantics, which were then moving on. And politics, and Morris was part of the romantics, of course.
Well, it's interesting to point out that William Blake is, like I say, from the working classes, from the lower middle classes, you want to call it that. And whereas, like later, like poets like Keats and Shelley and Byron, you know, were different, and also they could afford to write their poetry and not have to work. Blake was forced to work. He's right inside capitalism. He has to work inside it, and that's important to point out. The later romantics, could afford to sort of lie back and write their poetry and not have to earn a crust. Even William Morris, he didn't.
Not quite. Well, it's nice if you can do it, isn't it?
Yeah.
But a lot of unexpected people were in poverty. Jerome K. Jerome was in poverty. With another one.
Three men in a boat. I'm not surprised.
Yeah. Later on in life, it could have become six men in a boat, I suppose.
Yeah. Can I ask something, Steve? I know nothing about this William Blake, but I haven't quite got what his stance is. Was he a... what did he do or offer the working class or the peasants at the time, if I can put it like that? Well, they were the working class, and they
jumped
into the factories and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, this is the early period of capitalism.
He was writing for them, was he? Because surely...
No, he's an artist. He's probably writing for himself. He's creating art, but obviously he wants people to read it. He wants to realise the potential in humanity, which is the same as what Marx and Hegel are saying. In capitalism, because we are forced to sell ourselves... the economic, it forces us. We can't develop ourselves as human beings. Blake is saying it's commerce is causing this, and that's his word for capitalism. Because I don't think the word capitalism was really around at that time. Blake is not offering anything to the working class. He didn't set out to offer something to the working class. You're talking from the perspective of 2015.
I'm thinking about them times there. I'm not talking from this perspective.
He wanted an end to this exploitation. I mean, I was quoting these poems, end to exploitation of child labour, but also the enslavement of millions in factories. He just thought of this as being, this is not the way humanity should be developing. And so he's opposed to this developing capitalism. But he doesn't look back to feudalism. He's looking forward all the time. And, so that's... right at the beginning, I quoted from Dick Field. I mean, I think Blake needs to be better unknown and better appreciated by socialists. And I hope I've actually done that in the last hour. I've actually made it clear that Blake should be known and better appreciated by socialists.
I'm still waiting for the Mask of Oak from Shelley.
Yeah, this is William Blake. I mean, do you think now Blake is better appreciated by you as a socialist?
Well, I have to be honest with you. I've heard a lot of talk about mysticism, religion. I just find all that boring.
I haven't talked about religion or mysticism. I deliberately avoided that.
I've heard the word mysticism several times.
Richard referred to mysticism at some point.
Well, because he was a mystic.
But he was a mystic.
I answered the question for me just now. Yeah. I wanted to know what his position was and everything.
Yeah, caviar to the general.
Yep.
Do you think, if it wasn't for his paintings, that I think most people know rather than anything else, that we now know about his views, political and his views of the world, if he wasn't
I think this is poetry. Sorry, I beg to differ. This is poetry. It's, that's more, most important. Because these paintings, like, are engravings, which were, and they're small. If you've ever been to an exhibition of these paintings, they're not like huge things. They're really quite small. I think this is poetry. That's what people know. Because people know, you know, England's Green and Pleasant Land, that one. People know that. Tiger, Tiger, Burning Bright. People know that. And if the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear as it is, in, as it is infinite.
His poetry is pretty simple.
Yeah.
You can't compare with Shelley, for instance.
But I've only quoted these simple songs of innocence and experience. There's epic-length poems in here which are absolutely mind-boggling, and I've avoided those. I mean, I quoted a few times from them, but I didn't actually tell you where I was quoting from. But when I did quote, I was quoting from, like, the short ones. And... yeah, I mean, Shelley's different thing. Shelley's more political, respects. But what I'm actually saying, William Blake, as Dick Field said, should be better appreciated by socialists. And if I haven't convinced Jacqueline, then I've failed in this to actually convince socialists that Blake should be better appreciated.
I knew nothing about William Blake.
But,
all I heard is he wrote some poems which do not appeal to me. Yeah. It's as simple as that.
We've got another question here.
Perhaps not quite a question, but I like poetry and these ones that sort of eloquently point out the pain and misery, you know, the song of the shirt and all these things, and I particularly like the Brit, you know, who built the city up each time. About the work.
Hmm.
But whilst I sort of enjoy it, and I've certainly enjoyed the talk and the fact to appreciate it make more, but what I really find more exciting is the sort of political ideas, where the actual solutions are, not just pointing out how bad things are, the way the children are treated, the way children are still being treated.
Correct.
And not just saying things could be better, but pointing out how they could be better. The way the system that developed from that time to even more to be the full-blown capitalism, if you like, and how that now stands in the way of the real human development and enjoyment of art and literature and whatever else, and more fulfilling work, meaningful work, because fulfilling the real needs of human beings. But it's that side of it that I find the more exciting ideas, the ideas that show that there is a solution, that not only would we like things to be different, but we know that they actually could be different, because we would be capable, within enough of us joining to do it, to change the way things are run.
Mm-hmm. I say something about that because I sometimes write a bit of poetry. I didn't join the Socialist Party until 25 years ago. What was I doing before then? I was expressing myself in other ways, maybe feeling towards this. If Blake found a way of expressing these things with poetry, what do we say about Sassoon? He was stood against his class. But his war poems, as I quoted, were some of the most searing poems.
Second to none.
And so these people did express it in the way they could, as they felt at the time. Had I stopped where I was, had I died when I was, had anybody read what I wrote when I was in the CND and the Committee 100, I think, well, yeah, he was all right, but he didn't move along, did he? No, I was dead. Who knows? I mean, I always think about Blake and others. If only they could have lived a bit longer. And if the new ideas of dimensions had come into their life, they would have been radicalised, I'm sure. Mm. For me, I'm a great believer in the written word and the single line in a poem that changes your mind and makes you think again. And that is the value. And you say we can't claim he was a socialist. But
no.
Well, any more? Or are we adjourning? I've got some announcements to make. If there's a... Yes?
An announcement, if you like. This talk does have some contemporary political significance because in this constituency of Vauxhall, not only is there a Tory candidate, but there's a Whig candidate.
Yes, the Whigs have revived.
Really?
Yes.
You're part of the Whig Party.
You're joking.
We would love to have a debate with it.
Well, I may as well make the announcement. We're going to have a collection in a minute. As a matter of fact, I stood here, as you remember, in Vauxhall myself. I didn't do very well. But the interesting thing about that was the guy who is now MP, Richard Bacon, who was voted the MP, backbench MP of the year for his stance against the Iraq war, is now my MP. And when I see him, he says, I remember you, and you asked this question and that question. Now, there's a very important meeting coming up here in April. It's the Vauxhall election rally, when Danny Lambert is speaking. Sorry?
Anti-Whig rally.
Anti-Whig rally. And we should all try to get to that if we possibly can. That's really important. And the following month, in May, I should be appearing here myself. If you can only get to one of the two, you know which one to choose. The election rally. I shall be speaking on democracy, what it is and what it ain't, which is a good timing after the election. We're going to break for refreshments in a minute, but we're going to have a collection first. And meanwhile, if you've got any other questions, get them out now.
Yeah, I just want to emphasise again what Richard said. Yeah, you know, he's like Blake is someone to come to, and then he can, if you are untutored in radicalism or political ideas or anything progressive, he can push you in the right direction. Like I say, when I was 17 years of age, and I read these poems, it pushed me in the right direction. And that's.
Do you want to do a formal wind up?
No, not really. I mean, I've done a sort of formal conclusion anyway. But like I say, I think it's just important to, like, also I'll repeat what I said at the beginning. You know, he's pretty certainly the first person in English literature to realise that what we now call capitalism was not just the activity of individual merchants and early manufacturers, but a system. One that had wide-ranging and very damaging social consequences. And that understanding is scattered throughout his work, you know, throughout all his complete work. But it's concentrated in the poem London. So, as Richard said, Dick Field said, I think Blake needs to be better known and better appreciated by socialists. His writings are fathomless, and no matter how far you dive into it, you never seem to get anywhere near the bottom. I mean, I dived into Blake for this talk, and I nearly drowned in it.
Yeah. Thanks very much, Steve. Thank you very much.